everybody.
Good morning.
And this beautiful, beautiful early fall, late summer morning. And welcome to those we haven't seen before and those we have. This talk today is really something that is rarely directly addressed. It's probably way premature for people here who have just started practice, way late, way past due for those who've been practicing quite a while, and perhaps just right for others. It's the three bear situation, right? I want to start with a poem by Tony Hoagland, who is he died last year, a longtime Buddhist practitioner. And this is called Among the Intellectuals. They were a restless tribe. They did not sit in sunlight, eating grapes together in the afternoon. Cloud watching among them was considered a disgusting waste of time. They passed the days in an activity they called thought-provoking, as if thought were an animal and they used long sticks to poke through the bars of its cage, tormenting and arousing thinking into strange behaviors. This was their religion. That and the light shining through the stained glass ancestors. They preferred the name of the tree to the taste of the apple. I was young and I wanted to prove myself. But the words I learned from them transmuted me. By the time I noticed, the change had already occurred. It is impossible to say if this was bad. Inevitably, you find out you are lost, really lost, blind, really blind, stupid, really stupid. Dry, really dry. Hungry, really hungry. And you go on from there. But then you also find you can't stop thinking, tormenting, and talking to yourself. This is a guy who really knows where we all have been and are. And continue into. He's a very raw speaker. So, this talk is about what happens when we practice over time in a sustained way. How this unfolds, how the practice unfolds. There are many, many ins and outs of the experience of a life of practice. And this is a way of life. It's not just something that it's not like going to the movies and then you leave and you keep going. If you really dig in and settle in, it continues all the way through every moment of our life. And very often people, at a certain point when you've really established a practice, you're sick of it, you're bored with it, you just want to give it up, but you can't. You try and you can't. That's part of it. So we begin with life in the modern restless tribe, as he says. Now let's think for a minute. Let's imagine what it was like in the world of the Buddha 2,600 years ago in India. How quiet it was. How dark it was at night. How slowly everything moved, including bodies through space. It was mostly walking or riding in a cart pulled by an ox, walking rather in a lumbering fashion. Things were slow and dark and quiet, and the population was way, way less. This was the world in which he woke up to kind of the basis of our experience, of what it was like to experience consciously the life of the body and the mind. That was a very different cultural situation, in very, very different even physical circumstances than we now are raised in. The speed, the light, the noise, the distraction, the density of population. And any of us who are older even can directly experience how many more people there are in the world than when we were born. It's palpable. It was a way emptier world. So when we study the Dharma, it's really important to be informed by this cultural awareness. And some of what's happening as a result of Dharma coming into culture in the West now is the question of how to integrate our much more complex cultural experience, social experience, all of the influences through many generations of profound trauma. I mean, the history of human life is the history of trauma that has its lasting consequences. And it comes into what we need to work with in practice and what practice calls up in us when we have a sustained practice. We don't escape. We don't escape the direct experience of our own trauma. So most of us have lived, some of us have lived a lot outside, but most of us inside. Most of us are so physically contained and definitely in our thoughts and ideas as mostly who we think we are. So when we turn towards Buddhist practice, of course we bring these beliefs and attitudes and everything else with us wherever we go. They're central to our sense of self. This often you hear, or I've heard, I don't know if you've heard this, but enlightenment is not what you think. Which is two ways to understand that. It's not what you're expecting. It's not what you think it is. And it also has nothing to do with what you're thinking. But this can only be a freeing statement if you get it, if you realize it for yourself. Oh, okay, right. So enlightenment, which is not a word I use, but many people come to practice wanting enlightenment. It's an idea. But it's more than just an idea, an intellectual reward for sitting long, long and getting very tired of sitting. It's not a reward. Rather, if we talk about enlightenment, really what we're talking about is the possibility of transforming, the transformational, releasing, relieving, transforming view of our experience that comes through practice. We begin, it is a practice. There's a practice, there's no end point. It doesn't lead to a recital, it doesn't lead to an exam, it doesn't lead to an exhibition or a demonstration, except in that it affects how we experience every moment and how we come into the world and what we offer in the world every moment. But we don't practice to get something in particular or to show it off. We may begin practice with some almost magical idea of a bing, everything gets clear, everything changes. Wipes out our suffering, our confusion, our despair. Helps us with our social difficulties, our disappointing relationships with others and ourselves. But frequently, after the first flush of relief that comes when you hear the sanity of these teachings, which is certainly true for me, when I came across Dharma teachings, I thought, oh, what a relief. What a relief. Even though you may not understand a lot of it, and especially in Zen, the language can be pretty convoluted. Although, you know, once you've been practicing a while, it's absolutely straightforward. But we recognize when we hear the Dharma that this is something we've been looking for. And we recognize something essential about ourselves that doesn't get noticed anywhere else. And for a while, and maybe even for a really long time, we study and practice learning how to translate the teachings into something we can use. The Dharma tools, the tools of practice, such as precepts, such as clarifying a vow to awaken. There are many, many tools that are offered in the teaching. And those of you who have been attending Sanzen, which is the meeting with the teacher on a regular basis to clarify anything that's going on in the moment in relation to Dharma, the Dharma view, have heard over and over again from the teacher, just keep going. Okay, good, keep going. I certainly have heard that. And the beauty of it is, we always keep going. This is our life. There's nothing to say, okay, there, you've got it. If somebody says you've got it, you're probably going to go into a state of panic, like, really? Uh-oh. So Sanzen is very important to help us work with and look into very deeply our continuing dissatisfaction with our lives, our practice, our self, our states of mind, and continuing to not measure up to our expectations, which is such a common experience here. And we know, even though we want to be free, we don't want to be disillusioned. We don't want to be disillusioned, and yet this is all about understanding the illusions, the delusions that we don't even realize are skewing the way things are and leading to unhappiness and difficulties. So when we are released from what eludes us, when we keep going and seeing through and understanding and having some great experiences or having not very anything experiences, or find profound boredom and think that's a problem, it is not a problem. It is part of practice to be worked with in a very interesting way. But we come into doubting that the practice can work for us. You know, everybody else but not me. That's called skeptical doubt. That's one of the hindrances, skeptical doubt. It's only a hindrance if you believe it. If you think that it's because something's wrong. And then at that point, a lot of people drop practice or they start going to other groups or looking at other teachings or something like that. Which might lead them to something that actually helps them crack through whatever it is that's getting in the way of staying put, developing stability of practice. But often, then people come back. People come back to practice and say, okay, nothing else is even in the territory of my dissatisfaction, so I guess I'll just have to keep going. Doubt is really an important part of practice, and because it's the mind of belief and knowing is tippy. It's not firm any longer. You can see why this would be a very important ingredient in fully awakening to our human capacity. Is anything that we assumed was solid is not. Anything we assumed is going to stay put in one certain way isn't going to. So doubt is a really important part of practice. So Tony, in this poem, he says, inevitably you find out you are lost, really lost. Blind, really blind. Stupid, really stupid. Dry, really dry. Hungry, really hungry. And you go on from there. And this is, these are moments in deep practice that feel like that. The longing is deeper and deeper and deeper, and it's just not happening. I'm just not relieved of it. So I want to normalize this and say, yeah, this is the transformational arena. So now I want to talk about some bring the insights of modern day psychology into the ancient insight of the Buddha. Modern psychology really is born and must answer to current conditions, including all of the conditions that are being deepened by our media assault. Zen practice is definitely therapeutic, but it's not therapy. At the time of the Buddha, there was no therapy. There were the gods who you supplicated. But now we have therapy. So we recognize in the ordinary, it's the developmental process growing up, most of us experience some wounding or profound wounding freshly in our own life. This is to say nothing of what came in the many generations before us that was carried into what we received in our parenting and our natal family cultures, right? And we can call this the primal wound, some incident or an ongoing condition in our early life and natal families, whether it's violence that we grew up around, sickness, sexual abuse, just virulent criticism, unpredictable criticism or predictable, addiction, abandonment, loss and grief, or simply being of a certain temperament that felt overwhelmed all the time by the amount that was going on. One, all of the above influence our mind states, and it is that those conditions we formed our own sense of what the world was like and who we are in relation to it. It's all set up, and most powerfully before we had language, how it felt to be in a cherishing arms or in impatient arms or in no arms at all, right? I mean, there's so much that happens early on. And we carry these experiences and the strategies that we developed at the time in order to survive forward into our lives. And we are not even aware of them. Often. Sometimes we are. Sometimes we have stories we tell over and over and over again, but the stories don't necessarily help us actually really tune in to what that felt like. So we haven't actually really borne full witness to the profundity of the effects of that. But instead, we just believe it. We believe that we're inadequate, we're unlovable, we can't trust. And, of course, the world gives us endless opportunities to reinforce those beliefs because, you know, it is what it is. But we take it very personally. This is me. So often, this material, which is very, we are embedded in it, which means we are not aware of it. It doesn't come up in practice for quite a while. Some people come to practice initially because they've hit this place just anyway. But for a lot of people, it is submerged in strategies. And one of the things that we talk about in Right View, is one of the teachings, is Right View is free of strategy. But most of us have strategies. Nice, smiling, helpful, etc. Which is fine. That is also the bodhisattva way, but from a strategy-less source. You following what I'm saying so far? We may not get to this for a while, and what happens is we begin to emerge in the Sangha with a feeling that is oddly familiar of dissatisfaction, discord, exclusion, whatever. I mean, whatever our specialization is, victimization. And there is disappointment and disillusionment with the practice, with the Sangha, with the teacher, and with ourselves. This is a natural consequence of really recognizing, oh yeah, this old thing, this isn't the first time this is kind of, I've felt this way, but usually I've left or I've done something, tried to get everybody to change to be my way. Or so this is a really important moment in practice, and there's no way to skip over it, and it shouldn't be skipped over or taken at face value. This is a time when often people give practice up, which is sad, thinking that it's the failure, their own failure, or the failure of the practice. But it's really an important, important moment in practice, because what we're doing is we're going from translating to transformation. The self is really opening up and being rocked by the impossibility of the strategies. And everything that we thought we would get from practice, which is we would feel better and we'd da-da-da-da-da in some magical way without going here, we see the error of our belief. This is a particularly kind of dramatic presentation of this. Not everybody feels it quite so dramatically, by the way, and some people a lot more dramatically. It's just depending on everything about our temperament and our past. But the teachings at this moment begin to really transform us, and we are freed. We get freed from our project, our self-improvement and our world improvement project. And we can just settle down and relax. When we see how we've been creating and recreating all of our primal wounding, there's a lot that falls away. But not easily, and not without continuing to go right into the center of the experience, like going into a dark mine. I always think of the image of Bodhidharma in the cave, facing the wall, which is what we do when we turn. You know, for 9 years. Well, it can take 9 years. It can take, well, for me, 35 years. Long time until you get to that. But welcome whenever it happens. And we directly witness in the body the ancient grief and hurt. It's ancient, it's deep, and it is direct, and the view changes a lot from to kind of bearing witness to the whole difficulty of being a human being for those who wounded us, for ourselves. It's a very profound awakening of compassion, of the compassionate heart. And actually, this is really what Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara, Kanon, the Bodhisattva of compassion, who hears the cries of the world, she does not weep. She catches the tears, she bears witness with full quivering heart to the suffering. And that's really what we that's the transformation in our own internal formation. We deeply bear witness to what happened to us and how it has so skewed our ability to be really present and vital. So wallowing in the misery of our existential impossibility, we call it the primal wound, is just more suffering based on a misunderstanding of the teachings of emptiness. We wallow, wallowing as opposed to really feeling deeply in the body, in the physical body, the energy body, is not wallowing to hold on to, but staying with, to bear full witness to. That's the transformation, that's the change. We bear sympathetic witness to the child in us who is still experiencing the wounding and the feeling of being unsafe, unmet, unseen, unsupported, that you had originally, long before you could handle it as a little one. That's how the psychology, modern psychology and Buddhism really can work together to be quite potent. It's impossible to escape our karma in this way. What happened to us happened. We can't make it not have happened. Many years later, here we are living with the consequences. And they come up in our spirit, in our wish to be spiritually expansive and free and available. So we witness the feeling states that arise in our current circumstances and trigger us back into our old primal wound. And yet now we know it. Mara, now I know you. That's what the Buddha said. Now I know you. Now I know the source of these feeling states. And I bear witness, I bear tender witness. And this goes on and it spreads out. It's not like it happens once and it doesn't come up again. But it is a practice. It's a deepening, continuing unfolding of this view, which then begins to inform, suffuse your experience with other people when they are in their obnoxious ways. It can just bring incredible compassion. When you see through the behaviors, the strategies that we all use, we all do it. It's not. This is not from a place of criticism. This is from a place of insight. This is the freeing. This is how insight frees us. While we're still caught in the primal drama, we cannot discern with clear and undefended heart what's going on right now in this situation with these companions. Of course, we all bring our primal material along with us into our practice and into the Sangha, which feels like a family. And we can play out the familiar roles and conflicts in the Sangha. We do play them out. We have to include all of this insight into our primal material and our family histories, into how we reflect on Sangha relations. And this is very sticky and also very important. We call our new center the Sangha Jewel Zen Center. Oh, beware. I always, whenever we say it, I think of this aspect of it. Sangha is a jewel. But it's a jewel not because it's a place where we can, where suffering and confusion doesn't happen. Rather, it's a place where it does happen. The same old suffering emerges in a community where we're all working on awakening to the consequences of our, the difficulties that go way, way, way back, and have narrowed our view and have put our wounds at the basis for how we relate to everything. In our Sangha, over time, we are hopefully working with our culturally inherited attitudes that are very trauma-based, our habits of avoidance and attraction, as well as our personal primal wounds. We change our relationship to all of what makes up experience. This is the transformation of practice. And in this way, our practice helps us see much more clearly all the conditions that we bring to practice. Everything we are bringing, attitudes, views, beliefs that limit our sense of vitality and flexibility and kindness and joy, and keep us also from offering the full treasure of our gifts. Because as people deepen in practice, we are all free to offer our unique, specific offerings. We change our view, we change our minds. I have a friend, Susan, who, she's a grandmother of about 20 people, and she would always tell stories about difficulties that her various grandchildren were having, and she would take them by the shoulder and she'd say, change your mind. She taught them to be aware of everything that was going on for them. Can you imagine that? Change your mind. Saying this simple sentence in a way that really transmitted that this is serious, listen to me and think about it. The mind of the Bodhisattva, that's our vow. We take Bodhisattva vows. Hears the cries of the world, our own inner cries, and knows them, hears them, sees them, feels the tears, and bears witness to the source. All the way into the still open center of this present moment, where nothing is happening. So this is the thing that Buddha really brings to all of us. The still center of this present moment, when we're sitting in Zazen, watching the breath, what is going on? So all of these words, all of this talk today has been about the First Noble Truth, the truth of suffering, our own and the world's, and we must know it through and through. The First Noble Truth. Not to fear or try to bypass the grief, our personal and what's going on in the world. Not to bypass that, not to squish our energy or confusion or desolation, but recognize all of it as part of what we are awakening to, so that we can bear tender, poignant witness to this very human condition that we all share. We all share. The Buddha shared it. All the Bodhisattvas shared it. We all share it. This is the human condition. And this is the way to bring the awakened heart to help, to be of help, of service. May we all continue in our practice together.